what remained of it. It was the first village they had seen since leaving the foothills. Mira had scouted ahead to make certain there was no one lurking amongst the ruins, sliding in and amongst oaks and apple trees with her net and spear in hand. She startled three red deer and sent them bounding away through the brush. Summer saw the flash of motion and was after them at once. Bran watched the dire wolf lope off, and for a moment wanted nothing so much as to slip his skin and run with him. But Mira was waving for them to come ahead. Reluctantly, he turned away from Summer and urged Hodor on into the village. Jojen walked with them. The ground from here to the wall was grasslands, brand new. Fallow fields and low rolling hills, high meadows and lowland bogs. It would be much easier going than the mountains behind, but so much open space made Mira uneasy.
"I feel naked," she confessed. "There's no place to hide." "Who holds this land?" Jojen asked Bran. "The Night's Watch," he answered. "This is the gift, the new gift, and north of that, Brandon's gift."
Maester Lewin had taught him the history.
"Brandon the Builder gave all the land south of the wall to the Black Brothers, to a distance of 25 leagues, for their sustenance and support."
He was proud that he still remembered that part.
"Some maesters say it was some other Brandon, not the Builder, but it's still Brandon's gift. Thousands of years later, good Queen Alysanne visited the wall on her dragon, Silver Wing, and she thought the Night's Watch were so brave that she had the old king double the size of their lands to 50 leagues. So that was the new gift." He waved a hand. "Here, all this."
No one had lived in the village for long years, Bran could see. All the houses were falling down, even the inn. It had never been much of an inn, to look at it, but now all that remained was a stone chimney and two cracked walls set amongst a dozen apple trees. One was growing up through the common room, where a layer of wet brown leaves and rotting apples carpeted the floor. The air was thick with the smell of them, a cloying, cidery scent that was almost overwhelming. Mira stabbed a few apples with her frog spear, trying to find some still good enough to eat, but they were all too brown and wormy. It was a peaceful spot, still and tranquil and lovely to behold, but Bran thought there was something sad about an empty inn, and Hodor seemed to feel it too.
"Hodor," he said in a confused sort of way, "Hodor, Hodor."
"This is good land."
Jojen picked up a handful of dirt, rubbing it between his fingers.
"A village, an inn, a stout hole fast in the lake, all these apple trees. But where are the people, Bran? Why would they leave such a place?" "They were afraid of the wildlings," said Bran. "Wildlings come over the wall or through the mountains to raid and steal and carry off women. If they catch you, they make your skull into a cup to drink blood, old Nan used to say. The Night's Watch isn't so strong as it was in Brandon's day, or Queen Alexandre's, so more get through. The places nearest the wall got raided so much, the small folk moved south into the mountains, or onto the Umberlands east of the King's Road. The Great John's people get raided too, but not so much as the people who used to live in the Gift."
Jojen Reed turned his head slowly, listening to music only he could hear.
"We need to shelter here. There's a storm coming, a bad one."
Bran looked up at the sky. It had been a beautiful, crisp, clear autumn day, sunny and almost warm, but there were dark clouds off to the west now. That was true, and the wind seemed to be picking up.
"There's no roof on the inn and only two walls," he pointed out. "We should go out to the holdfast."
"Hodor," said Hodor.
Maybe he agreed.
"We have no boat, Bran."
Mira poked through the leaves idly with her frog spear.
"There's a causeway, a stone causeway hidden under the water. We could walk out."
They could, anyway. He would have to ride on Hodor's back. But at least he'd stay dry that way.
The reeds exchanged a look. "How do you know that?" asked Jojim. "Have you been here before, my prince?"
"No. Old Nan told me. The Holdfast has a golden crown, see?"
He pointed across the lake. You could see patches of flaking gold paint up around the crenellations.
Queen Alysanne slept there, so they painted the Merlins gold in her honour.
A causeway? Jojen studied the lake. You are certain?
Certain, said Bran.
Mira found the foot of it easily enough, once she knew to look. A stone pathway, 3 foot wide, leading right out into the lake. She took them out step by careful step, probing ahead with her frog spear. They could see where the path emerged again, climbing from the water onto the island and turning into a short flight of stone steps that led to the Holdfast door. Path, steps, and door were in a straight line, which made you think the causeway ran straight, but that wasn't so. Onto the lake, it zigged and zagged, going a third of the way around the island before jagging back. The turns were treacherous, and the long path meant that anyone approaching would be exposed to arrow fire from the tower for a long time. The hidden stones were slimy and slippery, too. Twice Hodor almost lost his footing and shouted, "Hodor!" in alarm before regaining his balance. The second time scared Bran badly. If Hodor fell into the lake with him in his basket, he could well drown, especially if the huge stable boy panicked and forgot that Bran was there, the way he did sometimes.
"Maybe we should have stayed at the inn, under the apple tree,"
he thought, but by then it was too late. Thankfully, there was no third time, and the water never got up past Hodor's waist, though the reeds were in it up to their chests. And before long they were on the island, climbing the steps to the Holdfast. The door was still stout, though its heavy oak planks had warped over the years, and it could no longer be closed completely. Mira shoved it open all the way, the rusted iron hinges screaming. The lintel was low.
"Duck down, Hodor,"
Bran said, and he did, but not enough to keep Bran from hitting his head.
"Oh, that hurt," he complained.
"Hodor," said Hodor, straightening.
They found themselves in a gloomy strong room, barely large enough to hold the four of them. Steps built into the inner wall of the tower curved away upward to their left, downward to their right, behind iron grates. Bran looked up and saw another grate just above his head.
A murder hole.
He was glad there was no one up there now to pour boiling oil down on them. The grates were locked, but the iron bars were red with rust. Hodor grabbed hold of the left-hand door and gave it a pull, grunting with effort. Nothing happened. He tried pushing, with no more success. He shook the bars, kicked, shoved against them, and rattled them and punched the hinges with a huge hand until the air was filled with flakes of rust. But the iron door would not budge. The one down to the undervault was no more accommodating.
"No way in," said Mira, shrugging.
The murder hole was just above Bran's head as he sat in his basket on Hodor's back. He reached up and grabbed the bars to give them a try. When he pulled down, the grating came out of the ceiling in a cascade of rust and crumbling stone.
"Hodor!"
Hodor shouted. The heavy iron grate gave Bran another bang in the head and crashed down near Jojen's feet when he shoved it off him. Mira laughed.
"Look at that, my prince," she said. "You're stronger than Hodor."
Bran blushed. With the grate gone, Hodor was able to boost Mira and Jojen up through the gaping murder hole. The Krennic men took Bran by the arms and drew him up after them. Getting Hodor inside was the hard part. He was too heavy for the reeds to lift the way they lifted Bran. Finally, Bran told him to go look for some big rocks. The island had no lack of those, and Hodor was able to pile them high enough to grab the crumbling edges of the hole and climb through.
"Hodor!"
he panted happily, grinning at all of them. They found themselves in a maze of small cells, dark and empty, but Mira explored until she found the way back to the steps. The higher they climbed,
the better the light. On the third story, the thick outer wall was pierced by arrow slits. The fourth had actual windows, and the fifth and highest was one big round chamber with arched doors on three sides opening onto small stone balconies. On the fourth side was a privy chamber perched above a sewer chute that dropped straight down into the lake. By the time they reached the roof, the sky was completely overcast, and the clouds to the west were black. The wind was blowing so strong it lifted up Bran's cloak and made it flap and snap.
"Hodor," Hodor said at the noise.
Mira spun in a circle.
"I feel almost a giant, standing high above the world.
There are trees in the neck that stand twice as tall as this," her brother reminded her.
"Oy, but they have other trees around them just as high," said Mira. "The world presses close in the neck, and the sky is so much smaller. Here, feel that wind, brother. And look how large the world has grown."
It was true. You could see a long ways from up here. To the south, the foothills rose, with the mountains grey and green beyond them. The rolling plains of the new gift stretched away to all the other directions as far as the eye could see.
"I was hoping we could see the wall from here," said Bran, disappointed. "That was stupid. We must still be 50 leagues away."
Just speaking of it made him feel tired and cold as well.
"Jojen, what will we do when we reach the wall? My uncle always said how big it was. 700 feet high and so thick at the base that the gates are more like tunnels through the ice. How are we going to get past to find the three-eyed crow?"
"There are abandoned castles along the wall, I've heard," Jojen answered. "Fortresses built by the Night's Watch, but now left empty. One of them may give us a way through."
The ghost castles,
old Nan had called them. Maester Lewin had once made Bran learn the names of every one of the forts along the wall. That had been hard. There were 19 of them, all told, though no more than 17 had ever been manned at any one time. At the feast in honour of King Robert's visit to Winterfell, Bran had recited the names for his uncle Benjen, east to west and then west to east. Benjen Stark had laughed and said,
"You know them better than I do, Bran. Perhaps you shall be first ranger, and I'll stay here in your place."
That was before Bran fell, though, before he was broken. By the time he'd woken crippled from his sleep, his uncle had gone back to Castle Black.
"My uncle said the gates were sealed with ice and stone whenever a castle had to be abandoned," said Bran. "Then we'll have to open them again," said Mira.
That made him uneasy.
"We shouldn't do that. Bad things might come through from the other side. We should just go to Castle Black and tell the Lord Commander to let us pass." "Your Grace," said Jojen, "we must avoid Castle Black, just as we avoided the King's Road. There are hundreds of men there." "Men of the Night's Watch," said Bran. "They say vows to take no part in wars and stuff."
"Aye," said Jojen, "but one man willing to forswear himself would be enough to sell your secret to the Iron Men or the Bastard of Bolton, and we cannot be certain that the Watch would agree to let us pass. They might decide to hold us or send us back. But my father was a friend of the Night's Watch, and my uncle is First Ranger. He might know where the Three-Eyed Crow lives, and John's at Castle Black, too."
Bran had been hoping to see John again, and their uncle, too. The last Black brothers to visit Winterfell said that Benjen Stark had vanished on arranging, but surely he would have made his way back by now.
"I bet the Watch would even give us horses," he went on.
"Quiet!"
Jojen shaded his eyes with a hand and gazed off toward the setting sun.
"Look, there's something. A rider, I think. Do you see him?"
Bran shaded his eyes as well, and even so he had to squint. He saw nothing at first, until some movement made him turn. At first he thought it might be Summer, but no.
A man on a horse.
He was too far away to see much else.
"Hodor!"
Hodor had put a hand over his eyes as well, only he was looking the wrong way. "Hodor!"
"He is in no haste," said Mira. "But he's making for this village, it seems to me. We had best go inside before we're seen,"
said Jojen.
"Summer's near the village," Bran objected. "Summer will be fine," Mira promised. "It's only one man on a tired horse."
A few fat, wet drops began to patter against the stone as they retreated to the floor below. That was well timed. The rain began to fall in earnest a short time later. Even through the thick walls, they could hear it lashing against the surface of the lake. They sat on the floor in the round, empty room amidst gathering gloom. The north-facing balcony looked out toward the abandoned village. Mira crept out on her belly to peer across the lake and see what had become of the horseman.
"He's taken shelter in the ruins of the inn," she told them when she came back. "It looks as though he's making a fire in the hearth." "I wish we could have a fire," Bran said. "I'm cold. There's broken furniture down the stairs. I saw it. We could have Hodor chop it up and get warm."
Hodor liked that idea.
"Hodor," he said hopefully.
Jojen shook his head.
"Fire means smoke. Smoke from this tower could be seen a long way off." "If there were anyone to see," his sister argued. "There's a man in the village. One man. One man would be enough to betray Bran to his enemies, if he's the wrong man. We still have half a duck from yesterday. We should eat and rest. Come morning, the man will go on his way, and we will do the same."
Jojen had his way. He always did. Mira divided the duck between the four of them. She'd caught it in her net the day before, as it tried to rise on the marsh, where she'd surprised it. It wasn't as tasty cold as it had been hot and crisp from the spit, but at least they did not go hungry. Bran and Mira shared the breast while Jojen ate the thigh. Hodor devoured the wing and leg, muttering, "Hum-dong," and licking the grease off his fingers after every bite. It was Bran's turn to tell a story, so he told them about another Brandon Stark, the one called Brandon the Shipwright, who had sailed off beyond the Sunset Sea. Dusk was settling by the time the duck and the tail were done, and the rain still fell. Bran wondered how far Summer had roamed and whether he had caught one of the deer. Grey gloom filled the tower and slowly changed to darkness. Hodor grew restless and walked a while, striding round and round the walls and stopping to peer into the privy on every circuit as if he'd forgotten what was in there. Jojen stood by the north balcony, hidden by the shadows, looking out at the night and the rain. Somewhere to the north, a lightning bolt crackled across the sky, brightening the inside of the tower for an instant. Hodor jumped and made a frightened noise. Bran counted to 8, waiting for the thunder. When it came, Hodor shouted, "Hodor!"
"I hope Summer isn't scared too," Bran thought.
The dogs in Winterfell's kennels had always been spooked by thunderstorms, just like Hodor.
"I should go see to calm him."
The lightning flashed again, and this time the thunder came at 6.
"Hodor!"
Hodor yelled again. "Hodor!
Hodor!"
He snatched up his sword as if to fight the storm. Jojen said,
"Be quiet, Hodor. Bran, tell him not to shout. Can you get the sword away from him, Mira?" "I can try." "Hodor, hush," said Bran. "Be quiet now. No more stupid hodoring. Sit down."
"Hodor!"
He gave the longsword to Mira meekly enough, but his face was a mask of confusion. Jojen turned back to the darkness, and they all heard him suck in his breath.
"What is it?"
Mira asked.
"Man in the village." "The man we saw before?"
"Other men, armed.
I saw an axe and spears as well. Jojen had never sounded so much like the boy he was. I saw them when the lightning flashed, moving under the trees. How many? Many and more. Too many to count. Mounted? No.
Hodor?
Hodor sounded frightened.
Hodor! Hodor!
Bran felt a little scared himself, though he didn't want to say so in front of Mira.
What if they come out here?
They won't, she sat down beside him. Why should they?
For shelter.
Jojen's voice was grim.
Unless the storm lets up. Mira, could you go down and bar the door? I couldn't even close it. The wood's too warped. They won't get past those iron gates, though.
They might. They could break the lock or the hinges or climb up through the murder hole as we did. Lightning slashed the sky, and Hodor whimpered. Then a clap of thunder rolled across the lake.
Hodor!
He roared, clapping his hands over his ears and stumbling in a circle through the darkness.
Hodor! Hodor! Hodor!
No! Bran shouted back. No Hodoring!
It did no good.
Hodor!
Moaned Hodor. Mira tried to catch him and calm him, but he was too strong. He flung her aside with no more than a shrug.
Hodor!
The stable boy screamed as lightning filled the sky again, and even Jojen was shouting now, shouting at Bran and Mira to shut him up.
Be quiet,
Bran said in a shrill, scared voice, reaching up uselessly for Hodor's leg as he crashed past, reaching, reaching. Hodor staggered and closed his mouth. He shook his head slowly from side to side, sank back to the floor, and sat cross-legged. When the thunder boomed, he scarcely seemed to hear it. The four of them sat in the dark tower, scarce daring to breathe.
Bran, what did you do?
Mira whispered.
Nothing. Bran shook his head. I don't know.
But he did.
I reached for him, the way I reached for Summer. He had been Hodor for half a heartbeat. It scared him. Something is happening across the lake, said Jojen. I thought I saw a man pointing at the tower.
I won't be afraid. He was the Prince of Winterfell, Eddard Stark's son, almost a man grown, and a warg, too, not some little baby boy like Rickon.
Summer would not be afraid. Most like they're just some umbers, he said, or they could be Nuts or Norries or Flints come down from the mountains, or even brothers from the Night's Watch. Were they wearing black cloaks, Jojen? By night, all cloaks are black, Your Grace. And the flash came and went too fast for me to tell what they were wearing.
Mira was wary.
If they were black brothers, they'd be mounted, wouldn't they?
Bran had thought of something else.
It doesn't matter, he said confidently. They couldn't get out to us even if they wanted, not unless they had a boat or knew about the causeway.
The causeway!
Mira mussed Bran's hair and kissed him on the forehead.
Our sweet prince, he's right, Jojen. They won't know about the causeway. Even if they did, they could never find the way across at night, in the rain. The night will end, though. If they stay till morning...
Jojen left the rest unsaid. After a few moments, he said,
They are feeding the fire the first man started.
Lightning crashed through the sky, and light filled the tower and etched them all in shadow. Hodor rocked back and forth, humming. Bran could feel Summer's fear in that bright instant. He closed two eyes and opened a third, and his boy's skin slipped off him like a cloak as he left the tower behind, and found himself out in the rain, his belly full of deer, cringing in the brush as the sky broke and boomed above him. The smell of rotten apples and wet leaves almost drowned the scent of man, but it was there.
He heard the clink and slither of hardskin, saw a man moving under the trees. A man with a stick blundered by, a skin pulled over his head to make him blind and deaf. The wolf went wide around him, behind a dripping thorn bush and beneath the bare branches of an apple tree. He could hear them, talking. And there, beneath the scents of rain and leaves and horse, came the sharp red stench of fear.
Catlin. The eastern sky was rose and gold as the sun broke over the Vale of Erin. Catlin Stark watched the light spread, her hands resting on the delicate carved stone of the balustrade outside her window. Below her the world turned from black to indigo to green as dawn crept across fields and forests. Pale white mists rose off Alyssa's tears, where the ghost waters plunged over the shoulder of the mountain to begin their long tumble down the face of the giant's lance. Catlin could feel the faint touch of spray on her face. Alyssa Aaron had seen her husband, her brothers, and all her children slain, and yet in life she had never shed a tear. So in death, the gods had decreed that she would know no rest until her weeping watered the black earth of the Vale, where the men she had loved were buried. Alyssa had been dead 6,000 years now, and still no drop of the torrent had ever reached the valley floor far below. Catlin wondered how large a waterfall her own tears would make when she died. "Tell me the rest of it," she said.
"The Kingslayer is massing a host at Casterly Rock," Sir Roderick Cassel answered from the room behind her. "Your brother writes that he has sent riders to the rock demanding that Lord Tywin proclaim his intent, but he has had no answer. Edmure has commanded Lord Vance and Lord Piper to guard the pass below the Golden Tooth. He advised you that he will yield no foot of Tully land without first watering it with Lannister blood."
Catlin turned away from the sunrise. Its beauty did little to lighten her mood. It seemed cruel for a day to dawn so fair and end so foul as this one promised to. "Edmure has sent riders and made vows," she said, "but Edmure is not the Lord of Riveron. What of my Lord Father?"
The message made no mention of Lord Hoster, my lady."
Sir Roderick tugged at his whiskers. They had grown in white as snow and bristly as a thorn bush while he was recovering from his wounds. He looked almost himself again. "My father would not have given the defence of Riveron over to Edmure unless he was very sick," she said, worried. "I should have been woken as soon as this bird arrived."
"Your lady sister thought it better to let you sleep, Maester Coleman told me."
"I should have been woken," she insisted.
"The maester tells me your sister planned to speak with you after the combat," Sir Roderick said.
"Then she still plans to go through with this mummer's farce?" Catlin grimaced. "The dwarf has played her like a set of pipes, and she is too deaf to hear the tune. Whatever happens this morning, Sir Roderick, it is past time we took our leave. My place is at Winterfell with my sons. If you are strong enough to travel, I shall ask Lysa for an escort to see us to Gulltown. We can take ship from there."
"Another ship?"
Sir Roderick looked a shade green, yet he managed not to shudder.
"As you say, my lady."
The old knight waited outside her door as Catlin summoned the servants Lysa had given her. If she spoke to her sister before the duel, perhaps she could change her mind, she thought, as they dressed her. Lysa's policies varied with her moods, and her moods changed hourly. The shy girl she had known at Riveron had grown into a woman who was by turns proud, fearful, cruel, dreamy, reckless, timid, stubborn, vain, and above all, inconstant. When that vile turnkey of hers had come crawling to tell them that Tyrion Lannister wished to confess, Catlin had urged Lysa to have the dwarf brought to them privately. But no,
Nothing would do but that her sister must make a show of him before half the Vale. And now this. "Lannister is my prisoner," she tells Sir Roderick, as they descended the tower steps and made their way through the Eyrie's cold white halls. Catelyn wore plain grey wool with a silver belt. My sister must be reminded of that. At the doors to Lysa's apartment, they met her uncle storming out.
"Going to join the Fool's Festival," Sir Brynden snapped. "I'd tell you to slap some sense into our sister if I'd all do any good. Bet you'd only bruise your hand."
"There was a bird from Riveron," Catelyn began, "a letter from Edmure."
"I know, child."
The black fish that fastened his cloak was Brynden's only concession to ornament.
"I had to hear it from Maester Coleman. I asked your sister for leave to take 1,000 seasoned men and ride for Riveron with all haste. Do you know what she told me? 'The Vale cannot spare 1,000 swords, not even one, uncle,' she said. 'You are the Knight of the Gate. Your place is here.'"
A gust of childish laughter drifted through the open doors behind him, and her uncle glanced darkly over his shoulder.
"Well, I told her she could bloody well find herself a new Knight of the Gate. Blackfish or no, I'm still a Tully. I shall leave for Riveron by evenfall."
Catelyn could not pretend to surprise.
"Alone? You know as well as I that you will never survive the high road.
Sir Roderick and I are returning to Winterfell. Come with us, uncle. I will give you your 1,000 men. Riveron will not fight alone." Brynden thought for a moment, then nodded a brusque agreement.
"As you say, it's a long way home, but I'm more like to get there. I'll wait for you below."
He went striding off, his cloak swirling behind him. Catelyn exchanged a look with Sir Roderick. They went through the doors to the high, nervous sound of child's giggles. Lysa's apartments opened over a small garden, a circle of dirt and grass planted with blue flowers and ringed on all sides by tall white towers. The builders had intended it as a godswood, but the eyrie rested on the hard stone of the mountain, and no matter how much soil was hauled up from the Vale, they could not get a weirwood to take root here. So the lords of the eyrie planted grass and scattered statuary amidst low flowering shrubs. It was there the two champions would meet to place their lives and that of Tyrion Lannister in the hands of the gods. Lysa, freshly scrubbed and garbed in cream velvet, with a rope of sapphires and moonstones around her milk-white neck, was holding court on the terrace, overlooking the scene of the combat, surrounded by her knights, retainers, and lords high and low. Most of them still hoped to wed her, bed her, and rule the Vale of Arryn by her side. From what Catelyn had seen during her stay at the Eyrie, it was a vain hope. A wooden platform had been built to elevate Robert's chair. There the Lord of the Eyrie sat, giggling and clapping his hands, as a humpbacked puppeteer in blue and white motley made two wooden knights hack and slash at each other. Pitchers of thick cream and baskets of blackberries had been set out, and the guests were sipping a sweet, orange-scented wine from engraved silver cups.
"A fool's festival,"
Brynden had called it, and small wonder. Across the terrace, Lysa laughed gaily at some jest of Lord Hunter's and nibbled a blackberry from the point of Sir Lynn Corbray's dagger. They were the suitors who stood highest in Lysa's favour, today at least. Catelyn would have been hard-pressed to say which man was more unsuitable. Ian Hunter was even older than John Arryn had been. Half-crippled by gout and cursed with 3 quarrelsome sons, each more grasping than the last. Sir Lynn was a different sort of folly, lean and handsome, heir to an ancient but impoverished house, but vain, reckless, hot-tempered, and it was whispered, notoriously uninterested in the intimate charms of women. When Lysa espied Catelyn, she welcomed her with a sisterly embrace and a moist kiss on the cheek. "Isn't it a lovely morning? The guards are smiling on us. Do try a cup of wine, sweet sister. Lord Hunter was kind enough to send for it.
from his own cellars. Thank you, no, Lysa, we must talk. After, her sister promised, already beginning to turn away from her. Now, Catelyn spoke more loudly than she intended. Men were turning to look. Lysa, you cannot mean to go ahead with this folly. Alive, the imp has value. Dead, he is only food for crows. And if his champion should prevail here...
A small chance of that, my lady,
Lord Hunter assured her, patting her shoulder with a liver-spotted hand.
Sir Vardis is a doughty fighter. He'll make short work of that sellsword.
Oh, will he, my lord? Catelyn said coolly. I wonder. She had seen Brunn fight on the high road. It was no accident that he had survived the journey while other men had died. He moved like a panther, and that ugly sword of his seemed a part of his arm. Lysa's suitors were gathering around them like bees around a blossom. Women understand little of these things, Sir Morton Wainwood said. Sir Varys is a knight, sweet lady. This other fellow, well, he's sort of all cowards at heart. Useful enough in a battle, with thousands of their fellows around them, but send them up alone, and the manhood leaks right out of them.
Say you have the truth of it, then, Catelyn said with a courtesy that made her mouth ache. What will we gain by the dwarf's death? Do you imagine that Jamie will care a fig that we gave his brother a trial before we flung him off a mountain?
Behead the man, Selin Corbray suggested. When the Kingslayer receives the imp's head, it will be a warning to him.
Lysa gave an impatient shake of her waist-long auburn hair. Lord Robert wants to see him fly, she said, as if that settled the matter. And the imp has only himself to blame. It was he who demanded a trial by combat.
Lady Lysa has no honourable way to deny him, even if she wished to, Lord Hunter intoned ponderously.
Ignoring them all, Catelyn turned all her force on her sister. I remind you, Tyrion Lannister is my prisoner. And I remind you, the dwarf murdered my lord husband. Her voice rose. He poisoned the hand of the king and left my sweet baby fatherless, and now I mean to see him pay. Whirling, her skirts swinging around her, Lysa stalked across the terrace. Selin and Sir Morton and the other suitors excused themselves with cool nods and trailed after her.
"Do you think he did?"
Sir Roderick asked her quietly when they were alone again.
"Murder Lord John, that is. The imp still denies it, and most fiercely."
"I believe the Lannisters murdered Lord Arryn," Catelyn replied. "But whether it was Tyrion or Sir Jaime or the Queen, or all of them together, I could not begin to say." Lysa had named Cersei in the letter she had sent to Winterfell, but now she seemed certain that Tyrion was the killer. Perhaps because the dwarf was here, while the queen was safe behind the walls of the Red Keep, hundreds of leagues to the south. Catelyn almost wished she had burned her sister's letter before reading it. Sir Roderick tugged at his whiskers.
"Poison? Well, that could be the dwarf's work, true enough. Or Cersei's. It is said poison is the woman's weapon. Begging your pardon, my lady. The Kingslayer now, I have no great liking for the man, but he's not the sort. Too fond of the sight of blood on that golden sword of his. Was it poison, my lady?"
Catelyn frowned, vaguely uneasy. How else could they make it look a natural death? Behind her, Lord Robert shrieked with delight as one of the puppet knights sliced the other in half, spilling a flood of red sawdust onto the terrace. She glanced at her nephew and sighed. "The boy is utterly without discipline. He will never be strong enough to rule unless he is taken away from his mother for a time." "His lord father agreed with you," said a voice at her elbow. She turned and beheld Maester Coleman, a cup of wine in his hand. "He was planning to send the boy to Dragonstone for fustering, you know. Oh, but I'm speaking out of turn." The apple of his throat bubbed anxiously beneath the loose maester's chain. I fear I've had too much of Lord Hunter's excellent wine. The prospect of bloodshed has my nerves all afray." "You are mistaken, Maester," Catelyn said. "It was Castle Rock, not Dragonstone, and those arrangements were made after the Hand's death, without my sister's consent." The Maester's head jerked so vigorously at the end of his absurdly long neck that he looked half a puppet himself.
"No, begging your forgiveness, my lady, but it was Lord John who—"
A bell tolled loudly below them. High lords and serving girls alike broke off what they were doing and moved to the balustrade. Below, two guardsmen in sky-blue cloaks led forth Tyrion Lannister. The Aerys' plump Septon escorted him to the statue in the centre of the garden, a weeping woman carved in vain white marble, no doubt meant to be Alyssa.
"The bad little man," Lord Robert said, giggling. "Mother, can I make him fly? I want to see him fly."
"Later, my sweet baby," Lysa promised.
"Trial first, draw Selin Corbray, then execution."
A moment later, the two champions appeared from opposite sides of the garden. The knight was attended by two young squires, the sellsword by the Aerys' master-at-arms. Sir Vardas Egan was steel from head to heel, encased in heavy plate armour over mail and padded surcoat. Large circular rundles, enamelled cream and blue in the moon and falcon sigil of House Aaron, protected the vulnerable junction of arm and breast. A skirt of lobstered metal covered him from waist to mid-thigh, while a solid gorget encircled his throat. Falcon wings sprouted from the temples of his helm, and his visor was a pointed metal beak with a narrow slit for vision. Bronn was so lightly armoured, he looked almost naked beside the knight. He wore only a shirt of black-oiled ringmail over boiled leather, a round steel half-helm with a nose-guard, and a mail coif. High leather boots with steel shin-guards gave some protection to his legs, and discs of black iron were sewn into the fingers of his gloves. Yet Catelyn noted that the sellsword stood half a hand taller than his foe, with a longer reach, and Bronn was 15 years younger, if she was any judge. They knelt in the grass beneath the weeping woman, facing each other, with Lannister between them. The Septon removed a faceted crystal sphere from the soft cloth bag at his waist. He lifted it high above his head, and the light shattered. Rainbows danced across the imp's face. In a high, solemn, sing-song voice, the Septon asked the guards to look down and bear witness, to find the truth in this man's soul, to grant him life and freedom if he was innocent, death if he was guilty. His voice echoed off the surrounding towers. When the last echo had died away, the Septon lowered the crystal and made a hasty departure. Tyrion leaned over and whispered something in Bronn's ear before the guardsman led him away. The sellsword rose laughing and brushed a blade of grass from his knee. Robert Aaron, Lord of the Eyrie and Defender of the Vale, was fidgeting impatiently in his elevated chair.
"When are they going to fight?"
he asked plaintively. Sir Vardas was helped back to his feet by one of the squires. The other brought him a triangular shield, almost 4 foot tall, heavy oak, dotted with iron studs. They strapped it to his left forearm. When Lysa's master-at-arms offered Bronn a similar shield, the sellsword spat and waved it away. 3 days' growth of coarse black beard covered his jaw and cheeks, but if he did not shave, it was not for the want of a razor. The edge of his sword had the dangerous glimmer of steel that had been honed every day for hours until it was too sharp to touch. Sir Vardas held out a gauntleted hand, and his squire placed a handsome double-edged longsword in his grasp. The blade was engraved with a delicate silver tracery of a mountain sky. Its pommel was a falcon's head, its crossguard fashioned into the shape of wings. "I had that sword carved for John in King's Landing," Lysa told her guest proudly as they watched Sir Vardas try a practice cut.
He wore it whenever he sat the Iron Throne in King Robert's place. Isn't it a lovely thing? I thought it only fitting that our champion avenge John with his own blade. The engraved silver blade was beautiful beyond a doubt, but it seemed to Catelyn that Sir Vardus might have been more comfortable with his own sword. Yet she said nothing. She was weary of futile arguments with her sister.
"Make them fight!"
Lord Robert called out. Sir Vardus faced the Lord of the Eyrie and lifted his sword in salute. "For the Eyrie and the Vale!" Tyrion Lannister had been seated on a balcony across the garden, flanked by his guards. It was to him that Bronn turned with a cursory salute. "They await your command," Lady Lysa said to her lord son.
"Fight!"
the boy screamed, his arms trembling as they clutched at his chair. Sir Vardus swiveled, bringing up his heavy shield. Bronn turned to face him. Their swords rang together, once, twice, attesting. The sellsword backed off a step. The knight came after, holding his shield before him. He tried a slash, but Bronn jerked back just out of reach, and the silver blade cut only air. Bronn circled to his right. Sir Vardus turned to follow, keeping his shield between them. The knight pressed forward, placing each foot carefully on the uneven ground. The sellsword gave way, a faint smile playing over his lips. Sir Vardus attacked, slashing, but Bronn leapt away from him, hopping lightly over a low moss-covered stone. Now the sellsword circled left, away from the shield, towards the knight's unprotected side. Sir Vardus tried to hack at his legs, but did not have the reach. Bronn danced farther to his left. Sir Vardus turned in place. "The man is craven," Lord Hunter declared. "Stand and fight, coward!" Other voices echoed the sentiment. Catelyn looked at Sir Roderick. Her master-at-arms gave a curt shake of his head.
"He wants to make Sir Vardus chase him. The weight of armor and shield would tire even the strongest man."
She had seen men practice at their sword play near every day of her life, had viewed half a hundred tourneys in her time, but this was something different and deadlier. A dance where the smallest misstep meant death. And as she watched, the memory of another duel in another time came back to Catelyn Stark, as vivid as if it had been yesterday. They met in the lower bailey of Riverrun. When Brandon saw that Petara wore only helm and breastplate and mail, he took off most of his armor. Petara had begged her for a favor he might wear, but she had turned him away. Her lord father promised her to Brandon Stark, and so it was to him that she gave her token, a pale blue handscarf she had embroidered with the leaping trout of Riverrun. As she pressed it into his hand, she pleaded with him. "He is only a foolish boy, but I have loved him like a brother, and it would grieve me to see him die." And her betrothed looked at her with the cool grey eyes of a Stark and promised to spare the boy who loved her. That fight was over almost as soon as it began. Brandon was a man grown, and he drove Littlefinger all the way across the bailey and down the water stair, raining steel on him with every step, until the boy was staggering and bleeding from a dozen wounds. "Yield!" he called, more than once. But Petara would only shake his head and fight on grimly. When the river was lapping at their ankles, Brandon finally ended it with a brutal backhand cut that bit through Petara's rings and leather into the soft flesh below the ribs, so deep that Catelyn was certain that the wound was mortal. He looked at her as he fell and murmured, "Cat," as the bright blood came flowing out between his male fingers. She thought she had forgotten that. That was the last time she had seen his face, until the day she was brought before him in King's Landing. A fortnight passed before Littlefinger was strong enough to leave Riverrun, but her lord father forbade her to visit him in the tower where he lay abed. Lysa helped their maester nurse him, She had been softer and shyer in those days. Edmure had called on him as well, but Petyr had sent him away. Her brother had acted as Brandon's squire at the duel, and Littlefinger would not forgive that. As soon as he was strong enough to be moved, Lord Hoster Tully sent Petyr Baelish away in a closed litter to finish his healing on the fingers upon the windswept jut of rock where he'd been born. The ringing clash of steel on steel jarred Catelyn back to the present. Sir Vardis was coming hard at Bronn, driving into him with shield and sword. The sellsword scrambled backward, checking each blow, stepping lithely over rock and root, his eyes never leaving his foe. He was quicker, Catelyn saw. The knight's silvered sword never came near to touching him, but his own ugly grey blade hacked a notch from Savada's shoulder plate. The brief flurry of fighting ended as swiftly as it had begun, when Bronn sidestepped and slid behind the statue of the weeping woman. Savardas lunged at where he had been, striking a spark off the pale marble of Alyssa's thigh.
"They're not fighting good, mother," the Lord of the Eyrie complained. "I want them to fight."
"They will, sweet baby," his mother soothed him. "The sellsword can't run all day." Some of the lords on Lysa's terrace were making wry jests as they refilled their wine cups, but across the garden, Tyrion Lannister's mismatched eyes watched the champions dance as if there were nothing else in the world. Bronn came out from behind the statue, hard and fast, still moving left, aiming a two-handed cut at the knight's unshielded right side. Savardas blocked, but clumsily, and the sellsword's blade flashed upwards at his head. Metal rang, and a falcon's wing collapsed with a crunch. Savardas took a half-step back to brace himself, raised his shield. Oak chips flew as Bronn's sword hacked at the wooden wall. The sellsword stepped left again, away from the shield, and caught Savardas across the stomach, the razor edge of his blade leaving a bright gash where it bit into the knight's plate. Savardas drove forward off his back foot, his own silver blade descending in a savage arc. Bronn slammed it aside and danced away. The knight crashed into the weeping woman, rocking her on her plinth. Staggered, he stepped backward, his head turning this way and that as he searched for his foe. The slit visor of his helm narrowed his vision. "Behind you, sir!" Lord Hunter shouted too late. Bronn brought his sword down with both hands, catching Savardas in the elbow of his sword arm. The thin lobster metal that protected the joint crunched. The knight groaned, turning, wrenching his weapon up. This time, Bronn stood his ground. The swords flew at each other, and their steel song filled the garden and rang off the white towers of the Eyrie.
"Savardas is hurt," Sir Roderick said, his voice grave.
Catelyn did not need to be told. She had eyes. She could see the bright finger of blood running along the knight's forearm, the wetness inside the elbow joint. Every parry was a little slower and a little lower than the one before. Savardas turned his side to his foe, trying to use his shield to block instead, but Bronn slid around him, quick as a cat. The sellsword seemed to be getting stronger. His cuts were leaving their marks now. Deep, shiny gashes gleamed all over the knight's armor. On his right thigh, his beaked visor, crossing on his breastplate, a long one along the front of his gorget. The moon and falcon rondel over Savardas's right arm was sheared clean in half, hanging by its strap. They could hear his labored breath rattling through the air holes in his visor. Blind with arrogance as they were, even the knights and lords of the Vale could see what was happening below them. Yet her sister could not. "Enough, Savardas," Lady Lysa called down. "Finish him now. My baby is growing tired." And it must be said of Savardas Egan, he was true to his lady's command, even to the last. One moment he was reeling backward, half crouched behind his scarred shield. The next he charged. The sudden bull rush caught Bronn off balance. Sir Vardas crashed into him and slammed the lip of his shield into the sellsword's face. Almost, Bronn lost his feet. He staggered back, tripped over a rock, and caught hold of the weeping woman to keep his balance. Throwing aside his shield, Sir Vardas lurched after him, using both hands to raise his sword. His right arm was blood from elbow to fingers now. Yet his last desperate blow would have opened Bronn from neck to navel, if the sellsword had stood to receive it. But Bronn jerked back. John Aaron's beautiful engraved silver sword glanced off the marble elbow of the weeping woman and snapped, clean a third of the way up the blade. Bronn put his shoulder into the statue's back. The weathered likeness of Alyssa Aaron tottered and fell with a great crash, and Savara's Egan went down beneath her. Bronn was on him in a heartbeat, kicking what was left of his shattered rondel aside to expose the weak spot between arm and breastplate. Savardas was lying on his side, pinned beneath the broken torso of the weeping woman. Catelyn heard the knight groan as the sellsword lifted his blade with both hands and drove it down and in with all his weight behind it, under the arm and through the ribs. Savardas Egan shuddered and lay still. Silence fell over the eyrie. Bronn yanked off his half-helm and let it fall to the grass. His lip was smashed and bloody where the shield had caught him, and his coal-black hair was soaked with sweat. He spit out a broken tooth.
"Is it over, Mother?"
the Lord of the Eyrie asked. "No," Catelyn wanted to tell him. "It's only now beginning." "Yes," Lysa said glumly, her voice as cold and dead as the captain of her guard.
"Can I make the little man fly now?"
Across the garden, Tyrion Lannister got to his feet.
"Not this little man," he said. "This little man is going down in the turnipoist. Thank you very much."
"You presume," Lysa began.
"I presume that House Aaron remembers its own words," the imp said. "As high as honour." "You promised I could make him fly,"
the Lord of the Eyrie screamed at his mother. He began to shake. Lady Lysa's face was flushed with fury. "The gods have seen fit to proclaim him innocent, child. We have no choice but to free him." She lifted her voice. "Guards, take my Lord of Lannister and his creature here out of my sight. Escort them to the bloody gate and set them free. See that they have horses and supplies sufficient to reach the Trident, and make certain all their goods and weapons are returned to them. They shall have need of them on the high road."
"The high road," Tyrion Lannister said.
Lysa allowed herself a faint, satisfied smile. It was another sort of death sentence, Catelyn realized. Tyrion Lannister must know that as well, yet the dwarf favoured Lady Aaron with a mocking bow.
"As you command, my lady," he said. "I believe we know the way."
Daenerys. The drapes kept out the dust and heat of the streets, but they could not keep out disappointment. Danny climbed inside wearily, glad for the refuge from the sea of Carthian eyes. "Make way!" Jogo shouted at the crowd from horseback, snapping his whip. "Make way! Make way for the Mother of Dragons!" Reclining on cool satin cushions, Zarozo and Daxus poured ruby-red wine into matched goblets of jade and gold, his hands sure and steady despite the sway of the palanquin.
"I see a deep sadness written upon your face, my light of love."
He offered her a goblet.
"Could it be the sadness of a lost dream?"
A dream delayed, no more. Danny's tight silver collar was chafing against her throat. She unfastened it and flung it aside. The collar was set with an enchanted amethyst that Zaro swore would ward her against all poisons. The pureborn were notorious for offering poisoned wine to those they thought dangerous,
but they had not given Danny so much as a cup of water. They never saw me for a queen, she thought bitterly. I was only